Setting the Record Straight with Chuck Coffin. Well, we're past Christmas, but there's such a thing at an end of a book, an afterward, afterthoughts. I still have some thoughts about Christmas that I want to talk about. Some aspects of Christmas are not too important, but perhaps the record ought to be set straight on those too. What about Christmas trees? What about the origin of Christmas trees? Do you know what their origin is? A little something about Christmas trees after Christmas in this beautiful season. But here on my Kentucky farm, it's an overcast day and it's sort of a light rainy day. The blue-gray overcast skies of Kentucky are displaying their usual winter color of many, many days at this time of year. But I'm reflecting a little bit on the history of Christmas trees. The Tannenbaum, the Christmas tree, a grand old tradition. Who started it? Probably the Germans. They started the Christmas tree tradition as we now know it back in the 16th century, when Catholics brought decorated trees into their homes. Some even built Christmas pyramids made of wood and evergreens attached to it and decorated with candles and a few ornaments, if wood was scarce. Well, that's Europe. But what about here in the New World? In the Americas? Most 19th century Americans found Christmas trees an oddity. The first record of one being on display was in the 1830s by German settlers, of course, in Pennsylvania. The Pennsylvania Dutch, we call them often. The Pennsylvania Dutch or German settlements had community trees way back, 1747, we know about. But as late as in the 1840s, Christmas trees were seen as pagan symbols and not accepted by most Americans. Well, the origin of using plants and trees, they remain green all year, for indoor decorations, did begin before the advent of Catholicism and Christianity. Seems to me it was a rather natural thing to bring some greenery inside in the winter, and in the summer too, to decorate the house. For my taste, I wouldn't say it had pagan origins or Judaic origins or Hindu origins. I said it had human origins, origins of the human race. Humans everywhere wanted plants inside the house. Look at the Japanese flower arrangements. Hey, how about the bonsais? Ancient old trees, dwarfed and beautifully shaped in large pots, which decorated the insides of Japanese houses. Look at the Japanese floral arrangements, which are ancient, very ancient. Just as people today decorate their homes during the festive season with pine, spruce, and fir trees, ancient peoples hung evergreen boughs over their doors and windows. In many countries, it was believed that evergreens would keep away witches, ghosts, evil spirits, and illness. Now, up here in the Northern Hemisphere, we have the winter solstice, the shortest day and the longest night of the year. The winter solstice falls on December 21st, or sometimes the 22nd. And many people in ancient times believed the sun was a god, and winter came every year because the sun god had become weak and sick. And they celebrated the solstice because it meant at last the sun god would begin to get well. Evergreen boughs reminded him of all the green plants that would grow again when the sun god was strong and summer would return. The ancient Egyptians worshipped a god called Ra, who had the head of a hawk and wore the sun as a blazing disk in his crown. At the solstice, when Ra began to recover from the illness, the Egyptians filled their homes with green palm rushes, which symbolized for them the triumph of life over death. Early Romans marked the solstice with a feast called the Saturnalia, in honor of their god of agriculture. Saturn, of course, Saturn. The Romans knew that the solstice meant that soon farms and orchards and vineyards would be green and fruitful. To mark the occasion, they decorated their homes and temples with evergreen boughs. In Northern Europe, the mysterious Druids, the priests of the ancient Celts, decorated their homes with evergreen boughs as a symbol of everlasting life. Evergreen, everlasting. The fierce Vikings in Scandinavia thought that evergreens were the special plant of the sun god, Balder. But actually, in the United States and North America, it shouldn't surprise us that the Christmas tree, along with all the other Christmas customs, were adopted so late. To the New England Puritans, who sort of started a trend in this country, Christmas was sacred, too sacred to celebrate, really. They thought it was papist, The Pilgrim's second governor, William Bradford, wrote that he tried hard to stamp out, quote, pagan mockery of the observance, penalizing any frivolity. And the infamous Oliver Cromwell preached against the heathen traditions of Christmas carols, decorated trees, and any joyful expressions that desecrated that sacred event. It was much too papist for them. They didn't allow Catholics, so why would they allow Christmas and celebrating Christmas? There is a very regrettable period in our history in the Anglosphere in which Christmas was illegal. It was part of the persecution of Catholics in the Anglosphere. Catholics were considered traitors, sometimes enslaved, exterminated, kept illiterate, drawn and quartered, and starved en masse. One could be arrested for eating mince pie in celebration of Christmas. For in that period, celebrating Christmas was illegal, as being much too Catholic. It was illegal in the British American colonies, just like in England. It's interesting in Dickens' Christmas Carol, Bob Cratchit, celebrating Christmas, thus exposes himself as being a hidden Catholic, and Dickens' Scrooge is plainly being very puritanical and Protestant as an anti-Christmas Brit. You know, from today's perspective, when you read the Christmas Carol, it seems sometimes that Charles Dickens knew he had to soft play the religious aspect of Christmas. It was much too papist and thus treasonous for the British crown, which was, in celebrating divorce in effect, declared the crown to be the new pope of the theocratic English Anglican Church. What Dickens and Clement Clark Moore's The Night Before Christmas accomplished was to make Christmas secular enough to be palatable, to be non-offensive in the Protestant culture, to be polite enough, and to be non-offensive in the USA, which had adopted the British culture as an ideal. English Protestantism secularized Christmas in order to celebrate it. It worked. It was successful. And we could have Christmas again. The project was complete. A trip at Christmas time to the Hallmark card aisle in a grocery store or Walmart will demonstrate for you that there are no longer any religious Christmas cards. Well, this last time there were a few. Out of 400 or 500, there were 6 or 7 that actually had a nativity scene. But most of them don't even have cherubs on them. It's all penguins and nutcrackers. We'd have to be blind not to see how this purposeful suppression of the sacred occurred. In 1659, the General Court of Massachusetts enacted a law making any observance of December 25th, other than a church service, a penal offense. You'd go to jail. People were fined for hanging decorations or eating mince pie. That stern solemnity continued until the 19th century, when the influx of German immigrants, and Irish immigrants too, liberalized this Puritan legacy, replaced the Puritan legacy, and celebrating Christmas became legal. Around the time of the Civil War, President Grant, soon after the Civil War, established it as a national holiday. Oliver Cromwell, who was really a military dictator that eliminated the crown and parliament, he banned Christmas festivities between 1649 and 1660 through the so-called Blue Laws. He believed that Christmas should be an extremely solemn day. Did you ever wonder how we got December 25th as Christmas? Who established that? Was that recent? No, it was quite long ago that it was established. Quite long ago. It was all the way back in 325 Anno Domini. Yes, 325 years after the birth of Christ. And who established it? Well, it was a Roman emperor, the first Catholic Roman emperor, Constantine the Great. Introduced Christmas as an immovable feast on 25th of September. He also introduced Sunday as a holy day in a new 7-day week, and introduced movable feasts like Easter. But Christmas failed to gain universal recognition among Catholics and Christians until quite recently. One source of this new popularity was perhaps unexpected. It was a certain British royal family. Now, Queen Victoria and her German Prince Albert were very popular with the people in the United States and throughout the Anglosphere. So, around 1846, the Illustrated London News published an edition that had an illustration of Queen Victoria and Albert standing with their children around a Christmas tree. Unlike the previous royal family, Victoria was so popular that what was done at court immediately became fashionable, not only Britain, but with a fashion called East Coast American Society. The Christmas tree had arrived. Well, in this country, by the 1890s, we were getting shipments of Christmas tree ornaments from Germany. Christmas trees' popularity was on the rise. It's noted that Europeans used small trees about 4 feet in height. Americans, well, we liked our trees to reach from the floor to ceiling. In the early 20th century, Americans decorated the trees mainly with homemade ornaments, while German-Americans continued to use apple nuts, marzipan cookies, popcorn, other things. You know how they use popcorn. They dyed it in various colors and then sewed it into long streamers and strings to loop around the Christmas tree and interspersed it along the string with cherries and various berries. But in this period of time, homes began to be wired with electricity. We got Christmas lights, making it possible for Christmas trees to glow for days on end. With this, Christmas trees began to appear in town squares across the country, on courthouse lawns, and having a Christmas tree in the home became an American tradition. Rockefeller Center in New York is located west of Fifth Avenue from the 47th through 51st Streets. That's where the nation has the Rockefeller Center tree. Having that tree there dated back to the Depression era days. The tallest tree ever displayed at Rockefeller Center came in 1948. It was a Norway spruce that measured over 100 feet tall. The first tree at Rockefeller Center actually was 1931. It was a small unadorned tree placed by construction workers at the center of the construction site. 2 years later, another tree was placed there, this time with electric lights. How many lights do you think are on the tree today? About 25,000. How about that? Well, let's talk about some other parts of North America other than the United States. Up in Canada, German settlers migrated there too in the 1700s. And so they brought all the things associated with Christmas, advent calendars, gingerbread houses, cookies, and Christmas trees. In Mexico, the principal holiday adornment is El Nacimiento, the nativity scene. But a decorated Christmas tree sometimes is incorporated in the setup elsewhere in the home. As purchase of a natural pine represents a luxury commodity to most Mexican families, the typical arbolito, or little tree, is often an artificial one, a bare branch cut from a copal tree, or some type of shrub collected from the countryside. Up in Greenland, farther up, Christmas trees are imported because they don't even have any trees. They don't live up that far north. Not anymore. They're decorated with candles and bright ornaments. Down in Guatemala, they also have the nativity scene, the Nacimiento, and it's joined by the Christmas tree. Maybe you didn't know it, there's a large German population in Guatemala, so they had to have their trees. They do have gifts left under the trees for the children. Parents and adults do not exchange gifts until New Year's Day. How about Brazil? Well, that's Southern Hemisphere. Christmas occurs during the summer, but they have fake snow, little pieces of cotton, decorating their pine trees that are their Christmas trees. You'll have to excuse me for mixing the sweet and the sour together. The sweet, the Christmas tree. The sour, the suppression of Christmas, the war on Christmas, is not only real, it's very old. Laws suppressing the celebration of Christmas were repealed in 1681, but that didn't end the suppression. The staunch Puritans continue to regard the day as an abomination. 18th century New Englanders viewed Christmas as the representation of royal officialdom, external interference in local affairs, and an impediment to their holy mission. The royal government closed Boston shops on Christmas Day and drove the schoolmaster out of town for a forced holiday. With such a burden placed upon Christmas, non-Puritans in colonial New England made little attempt to celebrate the day. They were more than discouraged. Many spent the day quietly at home. In 1771, Anna Winslow, an American schoolgirl visiting Boston, noted in her diary, quote, "I kept Christmas at home this year and did a good day's work." Although Christmas celebrations were legal after 1680, the officials continued to frown upon gift-giving and especially reveling. Evergreen decoration associated with pagan customs was expressly forbidden in Puritan meeting houses and discouraged in the homes. Merrymakers were even prosecuted for disturbing the peace. As late as 1870, classes were scheduled in Boston public schools on Christmas Day. That's after the Civil War. Punishments were given to children who chose to stay home beneath the Christmas tree. After the Civil War, Christmas became the festive high point of the American calendar. President Ulysses S. Grant's establishment of Christmas as a federal holiday, 1870, was part of his attempt to unite the cultures of the North and the South. And so the Puritan hostility was gradually relaxed. And of course, the secularization of Christmas made it more palatable, as I said earlier, and erasing many of the associations with Catholics that caused the suppression to start with. Well, let's end on a more joyous note, because Christmas is a time of joy. The sharing of the gospel is a time of joy, as in chapter 1 of the first epistle of John. That last sentence. John has written to his small congregation that he wants to bear witness of the incarnation. The incarnation occurred on Christmas. I here yield to the opinion of many scholars that it was the appearance of Gabriel to Mary that is being celebrated on December 25th. And upon her agreement to give herself to God. In that most incredible moment in history, the incarnation occurred. 9 months later, Christ was born. And as an adult, he had his apostles. And they knew him, and they saw him. After his resurrection, they saw him, and lived alongside him in his presence. In John 1, he's giving witness to his small congregation that he has seen it with his own eyes. He's touched it. He's been in its presence. And he and the apostles, he speaks for the apostles when he says, "And these things write we unto you, that your joy may be full." He means he's writing of the incarnation, which he's seen and heard with his own eyes, which we have looked upon, the we as the apostles, and our hands have handled the word of life. For the life was manifested, and we've seen it, and bear witness, and show unto you that eternal life, which was the Father. And then he says, "And these things write we unto you, that your joy may be full." Because Christmas is the incarnation. And I want to close on this joyful note. Every year in early December, I try to make a concert that the First Presbyterian Church in Shelbyville, Kentucky does. It's always a splendid concert. It's a small town, a small church. But they really go beyond themselves in filling us all with joy that attend this, with the glory of their sound of that choir and their small orchestra. Allow me to play you a little selection from this year's concert. This was their opening. This is a setting by Philip Nicolai, "Awake, the Night is Flying." This recording was made on December 3rd, 2017. It's the concluding minute of the opening. From Setting to Recostrate, from Breadbox Media, from Chuck Coughlin. Merry Christmas to y'all. God bless us all, each and every one.